Welcome to class today. For those on the listening on the podcast, we're recording it just a little bit differently, but you should be able to hear the discussion that is going on in the background. Okay. All right. That said, this should be a fun one, and we'll see if it's today's class or both classes. But it's going to come right on the heels of Joseph F. Smith's time spent with the Smoot hearings that we talked about last week. So I got looking at this, and we've got to go backwards and just remind ourselves of everything that Joseph F. Smith did. He's got quite a colorful history that we don't always necessarily recognize. Okay, so Joseph F. Smith. Remember, he is nearly six when his father Hiram was killed. He did have a slight memory of just before Joseph and Hiram ride off to Carthage, being bounced on Joseph's knee, and Joseph turning to his mother and saying, "Aren't you feeding this boy very well?" You know, so he does have that. He did live that life having a very slight memory of the prophet Joseph. But he's nearly six when his father Hiram is killed. So at seven, about 18 months later, he actually is going to be the primary driver of the family wagon to winter quarters. So mom is trying to handle other kids and stuff like that, but at seven, he's driving the wagon to winter quarters, which is kind of amazing. When he finally gets all the way to Utah, and he will ride and he will drive the wagon most of the way, but there is that story. We remember that it was their wagon, Joseph Mary Fielding's wagon, that just outside Immigration Canyon. What happens?
The ox dies.
The ox dies.
It doesn't die.
But it collapses. It's been a long way over there. And so they give it. Did she give it the priesthood blessing?
Mm-hmm. No.
It's arguable.
Do we know who blessed the oxen?
No, but she calls her somebody to do it.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard it both ways. There was an oxen that was blessed that then rises up and gets them the rest of the way into the valley. And so that's like at 8 and 9. Joseph F. is doing that. When he gets to the valley in 1852, he is orphaned. Mary Fielding dies in 1852. So now he's at 13. He's an orphan, and he has the primary responsibility for his younger sister, Martha. Okay. At 15, he's called on a mission to Hawaii.
Why?
Well, the teacher in school decided that she was going to try and whip Martha for not doing what Martha was supposed to be doing. Joseph F. then punched her out. At 15, yeah. And he will actually, in an article in the Improvement Era, he will say that he had a problem with anger in his early years. He was angry that he had been orphaned and angry that he had lost both of his parents. And so he was kind of upset about all of that, okay? And he said he had an anger problem. He did. And in all fairness, I will just say that his first wife will end up divorcing him because of his anger problem, okay?
I think if you're 15 and an adult tries to whip your sister who's littler, I personally totally would...
You think you'd do it?
Well, he didn't whip his
sister. Whatever
I
could to that adult.
Yeah, what's that?
Didn't he whip the teacher? He didn't whip his sister.
No, he whipped the teacher.
He whipped the teacher.
He took the teacher on.
Right. The teacher was trying to whip his sister.
Right,
and
right.
So he
was
going to
not let that happen, and now I'm in charge. So Brigham and Heber C. Kimball decide it would be better for this boy to go on a mission. He's got a problem. So that's what they did. And so he's then going to end up going to San Francisco. He's called to the Sandwich Islands, which today we call
Hawaii.
He's going to go to the Sandwich, but he's got to go to San Francisco and work for his passage to be able to afford to be able to go on to the Sandwich Islands. He will then serve for 4 years as a missionary. He learns the Hawaiian language. He serves for 4 years there, and And he's actually the head of the church in Maui, I think. At which point the Utah War is beginning. Johnson's army is coming. He is then called back to Utah. He will then make his way back. And the story is true that as he's making his way from San Bernardino through Las Vegas up to Salt Lake, that they are stopped by some mobsters that are want to know if there's any Mormons in this camping group. And Joseph F. did say that he was a Mormon boy, yes siree, through and through. And he just stands there proudly, and then they, okay, you are the happiest man I've ever seen, and send him on. Okay?
Do you not find it interesting that in current days, if kids are having trouble, they are not sent on mission? But in this case...
I thought there was always a sense, too, from Brigham Young and others, that this was the son of the prophets. So they've got their eye especially on Joseph F. And so they're going to take care of him, and he's going to kind of rise to that challenge. But he's got an anger problem.
But I think that there's a bit of wisdom in this, and that it could be applied.
You're suggesting that we ought to be doing that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I know personally in our state there was a young man that had a problem that they didn't send on a mission, and he went inactive and everything. And had he just been given that extra chance,
instead of doing those things, send him on a mission.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
The structure of a mission in Hawaii in the 1860s is completely different than the structure of a mission in 1960s.
Than sending them to downtown Detroit to knock on doors. Yeah. Well, and I would have thought that would be maybe that would be a good way to rehabilitate them back in. Yeah.
This is kind of a minor point, but do you remember back in Relief Society and priesthood where we had a pamphlet and we would spend the entire year on the teaching?
On that particular prophet?
Mm-hmm. Well, the year I was teaching, the year Joseph F. Smith, and it said in there that he wasn't baptized till he was like 12, 13, I assume, before 15. Yeah. And I wrote Salt Lake and asked him why, because I'm in my head, why wasn't he baptized when he was 8? I guess they were so busy.
Yeah.
But finally someone realized one day, hey, you've never been baptized.
So he was actually baptized in the valley after he got there.
Yeah,
Wow.
And I can see, look, his father gets assassinated. They got to go across the plains. They got to survive. They just, one of those things that's, I guess the ward clerk just let that slip through or something. But anyway, I just always thought it was funny. Things weren't as regimented then.
Well, and the other possibility, too, remember that a lot of times after they got into the valley, almost everybody was rebaptized.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was a really common thing. In that very first week after, in 1847, when they go into the valley, they, including Brigham Young, they all went into the river and were rebaptized. Because back then it was also kind of a recommitment to your covenants.
In 1980, my elders quorum president was made an elder after he'd been elders quorum president for 5 or 6 months.
Where was this?
In Yakima, Washington.
Did they do the church different in Yakima?
No. I came into sacrament meeting one day, and the state presidency was all on the stand, and the bishopric was on the stand, and I thought, oh, we're getting a new bishop, and I'm looking for old people. We're in the singles ward. And I don't see any other old people. And then the stake president gets up and says, well, sometimes we make mistakes in the church. And it's been noted that your elders quorum president is a priest. And so we're going to rectify that. And
we're going to undo elders. All the blessings he did and all the setting apart that he did. We start over.
So Raul Laura.
That's funny.
And he was one of the best elders quorum presidents I'd ever had.
And started as a priest.
He still had the ministering of angels.
So. Yeah, they make up for stuff like that. Anyway, so in 1857, Joseph F. comes back to Utah. He actually serves in the Nauvoo Legion. And so he's part of that. And then in 1860, he's called on a mission to England. So he's been 4 years in Hawaii, a couple of years there in Utah taking care of this, then things are settled down. 1860, he's called on a mission to England. In 1863, he's called home. Now, I think that's interesting that both on his way to England in 1863, on his way back, he's coming across the United States, which is in the middle of fighting at the Civil War. So trying to, this was kind of treacherous at times, depending on where he went. So he's now called home. And why is he called home? Well, they had to send him to Hawaii along with Lorenzo Snow because there was a guy claiming to be a prophet in Hawaii who was kind of taking over and taking advantage of the Utah War. All the leaders are out of there, and some guy rise up and tried to be a prophet. So he and Lorenzo Snow and a couple of others go to Hawaii.
They had to go back to Maui.
Yeah, is that what it was?
It was in Maui, yeah.
Okay, now, so this is where, it's at one point they're trying to go between islands, and this is where the story you've heard where Joseph is saying, this isn't going to be we shouldn't do this, I got a bad feeling about going to this island. The captain wants to go anyway, so then they get in the boats on their way to the shore. The boat capsizes. Joseph F. is nearly drowned, and Lorenzo Snow is drowned. He's lifeless when his body washes up. Okay, now let me take a step back for just a second. Okay, if we go back to the Missouri problems. One of the worst moments in Missouri history is the Hans Mill massacre. Okay, at Hans Mill, remember they're shooting into cabins. Everybody is combined together, and the Smith family, the Smiths, not related to the father is killed, and one of the kids is killed, and one of the and when the smoke clears, the mother finds. Alma?
Yes.
Alma Smith, okay, has had his hip blown off. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Okay, and mom puts a poultice together of lime and...
Elm.
Yeah, elm, and puts it on there, and miraculously, his hip heals.
I think that was by revelation.
Yeah, she had this inspiration that this is how she... Had. So anyway, she saves his hip, saves his life. When Lorenzo Snow comes washing ashore in Hawaii, guess who the missionary is that finds him? Alma Smith. Who then feels inspired to take a barrel, and they lay his lifeless body over the barrel, and they keep rolling him back and forth over the barrel until he suddenly starts spitting up water, and it's Alma Smith who's going to save the life of Lorenzo Snow. How's that?
Wow.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool story. Anyway, so he's going to go to Hawaii. Then in 1866, he's called back to Salt Lake, where he is ordained an apostle.
What age?
That's a good 28. Question. 28. Is that about that? Yeah, that would
be. Plus or minus one.
Yeah, something like that. Okay. So he's ordained an apostle. Now as an apostle, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to send him on another mission back to England. Because he's going to organize all of those things, and he's going to serve for several years. And by the time he's done, because he's an apostle, he will serve as the president of the European mission, including trips up to Hungary, down to France. And so he's kind of gone from that to that to that. Okay. Then he's going to come back, and then in 1877, they're going to send him back to a short mission, back to England again. Okay. Then in 1880, he's going to be named to the first presidency under John Taylor. Okay. So you just get a feeling that he is just, from age 13 onward, his life has just been really crazy. Now, by the way, in the middle of that, he will marry his second wife. And that goes a whole lot more better. And then in 1901, then he's going to become president of the church in time to deal with all of the Smoot hearings that we talked about last week. So with Joseph F., his life is interesting. Now, in the middle of that, yeah.
Well, then he became president. He was like the first, second generation of LDS to become a prophet. Everybody else had been in there with Joseph Smith.
Yeah. So now you're getting the second generation. You're getting Heber J. Grant and all those that have that second generation. That's it.
Did he go on to marry plural wives?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Lots. Okay. Now, so, in order to set up what we're going to be talking about today, there's a series of incredible revelations that occur. So that's Joseph F. Now I want to set the setting in which these revelations are going to be received. So there's the person. You see the person. Now here comes the time. And the time is the Great War. Okay, this is the war to end all wars in Europe. And the scale of this thing is, it's actually started about 1915, 1916, right in there. And I think we have a hard time understanding what life was like. They're still working in trench warfare, which really means if we're going to try and gain ground, we're going to rush thousands of people across the battleground right into the guns. The problem that they found, they should have learned at Gettysburg, that our weapons are getting better. We are becoming more efficient at killing people quickly. You know, in the old days, without a rifled bullet, the bullets might go everywhere. But if you can rifle your bullet, and now it'll stay right on track where you're pointing it, okay? And now we got machine guns and mustard gas, and we are much better killing machines. And so what's going to happen, we get the battle, for instance, December 1816, the Battle of Verdun. Casualties, 700,000. In total, with French and Germans' losses being roughly equal. Over about a four-day period, 700,000 people die. Yeah. And you start to try and comprehend your mind around that. Did they learn from that? No. Now we get the Battle of the Somme. Okay, how'd that one go? Well, casualties. Over 1 million casualties, with British suffering over 420,000 people. The French, 195, the Germans, 650,000 over a matter of just a few days. And this is going to get us the poppies and all that, because that's happening in that area, okay? By the way, who's in the middle of this battle? J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis both are part of this, okay?
When you drive through that area now, I mean, it is the most beautiful.
Yeah, the poppies still grow out there, don't
they? We spent lots of time through that area.
Wow. Okay. So this is what's happening now. The United States, up to this point, up to 1916, late 1916, is staying out of this. This is a European war, and we're grateful that we're not participating in all of this mess. But it just is getting worse and worse and worse. So what's going to happen is the U.S. is going to then have a discussion in the Senate. So before that, let's back up just a little bit. So there is one other thing going on here. With all the millions dying in the Great War, the other thing that's going on, and it's just a little bit later, but it's already started, and that is the Spanish influenza. Okay? How many died in the Spanish influenza? Well, 1918 and 1920, the flu pandemic is known as the Great Influenza Pandemic, and they were back to wearing masks back then and all that. Okay? Earliest documented case was March 1918. That's going to figure in here for one of our revelations. In Kansas, further recorded in France, Germany, United Kingdom in April. How'd that go? A third of the global population, an estimated 500 million people had been infected. Estimates of death from 17 million to 50 million, possibly as high as 100 million.
Spread by the fact that It actually started in Kansas, and government kept it flat as they were shipping soldiers around.
Yes, and so then we're actually carrying it over there, and then it just explodes over there. Yeah. So think about that. You've got the war with millions dying, and then you've got the influenza with people dying. So Joseph F. is surrounded by death. There's constant death all the time.
One of the things I learned in genealogy is that they believe that it started at Fort Leavenworth, and it came about because they had so many mules then, because everything wasn't mechanized then. They had so many mules, and they were burning the feces of the mules to get rid of it. And that's what started it. And it came from the pollution that was...
Wow, breathe that and get the flu.
And they knew that half of the soldiers they shipped overseas would die.
And if I remember right, you get the flu and you're dead in like 3 days, aren't you? I mean, it was really rapid. Okay, all right. So in the middle of all of this, then they have to make a decision. So in April 1917, they're having a discussion in the Senate, and guess who's leading the charge? Senator Smoot. After all the stuff that they'd gone through 10 years earlier with Smoot about, you know, this polygamist that doesn't polyg, that one. So he sends a message to President Smith, and he says, "I had my notes prepared to speak in favor of the resolution, but before asking recognition late in the evening, the impression came for me not to speak but to offer an appeal in the form of prayer. Just before 11 o'clock, I obtained recognition from the Vice President. The galleries were packed, and I waited until you could hear a pin drop in the chamber. And then I said, 'Mr. President, I rise to make this simple but earnest appeal. God bless and approve the action to be taken by the Senate this day. Oh, Father, preserve our government and hasten the day when liberty will be enjoyed by all the peoples of the earth.'" Okay. "I do not believe that there's ever been such a statement made in the Senate that had an effect on this, as this prayer had upon the senators, but everybody in the galleries. No further remarks were made on the resolution, and the vote was taken upon it and passed." So in other words, we now have a responsibility to preserve liberty, and we will now enter the war. Okay? All right. So there's our setting. Okay? Now, at the same time, Joseph F., I want to remind you this. This is from last time. Okay? Remember in the Smoot hearings when he's being asked, "Have you ever received a revelation?" You remember that Joseph F. says, "Well, I can say this, that if I live as I should in the line of my duties, I'm susceptible to the impressions of the Spirit upon my mind, just as any good Methodist would be. So far as that concerned, I'd say, yes, I've had impressions upon my mind frequently, but they are not in the same sense revelations." So in 1906, he's saying, "I don't believe I've had any revelations." Well, that's about to change in a really big way. Okay. So one scholar looking on what's going to happen between 1916 and 1918 is going to say this: "It's doubtful that if at any period of like duration in entire history of the church, so much detail as to the nature of life after death has been given to any other prophet of this dispensation. Our understanding of what happens on the other side just exploded because of the revelations that Joseph had
received." Wasn't his mother Jerusha too? No,
his mother was Mary Fielding.
I thought she was his stepmom. Mm-hmm. I think I read that somewhere. And so that's if Jerusha was his mom, that was even more bad.
I'll ask Dr. Google if you want me to.
Yeah, you can do that. That's actually going to play into this.
Yeah.
Because just prior to the 1916 conference, he is in deep depression. Why? Because one of his wives has died, and it probably was Jerusha, I would imagine.
Yeah.
He's been ill. He hasn't been able to get out of his room. He's been sick a lot. He's kind of in and out of... kind of some consciousness. He had another son, Hiram Smith, newly ordained, had died. He had one other son that was already an apostle, and that was Joseph Fielding Smith.
His mother is Mary Fielding
Smith. Yeah, that's
Mary
what
Fielding.
Saying. Okay.
So Jerusha was maybe the, I think Jerusha was his second wife, and he really loved her.
Yeah.
Really did. So Hiram Smith has died, and he was assuming that he would probably grow to be the, as a possibility, a prophet. He's newly ordained. He dies. And then Jerusha dies as well. So he's actually in quite a state. Okay? And then he's going to stand up then. And the Great War is now in full swing. And so he's really frail. And he'd been in bed most of the week. And then he gets up in 1916, April. And he gives what I personally consider to be maybe one of the greatest, if not the greatest, General Conference talk ever. And we've had some good ones. This, I think, is spectacular. Okay? So, April Conference, 1916. And you have to bear with me because there's so much. I thought about trying to edit a number of things, but there's so much in here that I didn't want to cut out much. So, I believe, he says, that those who've been chosen in this dispensation and in former dispensations to lay the foundation of God's work in the midst of the children of men for their salvation and exaltation will not be deprived in the spirit world from looking down on the results of their labors, efforts, and mission assigned to them by the wisdom and purpose of God to help redeem and reclaim the children of the Father from their sins. Okay? So, he says, I feel confident, and this is always kind of thrilling a bit, that the eye of Joseph, the prophet, and the martyrs of this dispensation, and of Brigham, and John, and Wilford, and those faithful men who are associated with them in this ministry upon the earth, are carefully guarding the interests of the kingdom of God, which they have labored, and for which they strove during their mortal lives. I believe that they are as deeply interested in our welfare today, if not with greater capacity, with far more interest beyond the veil than they were in the flesh. Sometimes I think, and it's been suggested sometimes, that those on the other side of the veil, whether they're, whoever they are busy doing other things to be that involved in the affairs of our lives. And what Joseph F. is saying, no, you're their work. They are very involved in our lives. And he'll go on to kind of punctuate that. But especially in this case, he starts with the idea that Joseph and Brigham and John and Wilford and Lorenzo are watching us. And I live my life in their view. So he's going to say, I believe they know more. I believe their minds have expanded beyond the comprehension in mortal life, and that their interests are enlarged and expanded in the work of the Lord, which they gave their lives in best service. Although some may feel and think this is a little extreme to take this view, yet I believe it is true. And I have a feeling in my heart that I stand in the presence, not only of the Father and the Son, but in the presence of those who God commissioned, raised up and inspired to lay the foundations of the work in which we are engaged. How's that feel? Amazing? Yeah.
So I think a lot of members or individuals try to anticipate that the focus of their departed predecessors is on their temporal affairs.
Yeah.
And we're maybe disappointed that my grandfather isn't making sure that I'm healthy or that I don't go bankrupt or get in a car accident.
Yeah.
And that's all temporal stuff that I think they don't interfere with.
Yeah.
You know? But this is the spiritual stuff and the development of the gospel and of sanctification of individuals
is that their calling to us haven't stopped. I mean,
right.
Apparently, if if you're a father or mother on this life and you feel some responsibility for your kids, what he's saying is you get to the next life, there's still some responsibility there. Okay? And that you're going to, in some way, and the thing that I find really gratifying is the fact that their minds have expanded beyond their comprehension in mortal life, and interests are enlarged and expanded. And he'll say more of that in a second. You thinking?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Could that be true for people in leadership? I don't know, because I've always understood that the people on the other side of the veil aren't able to necessarily look down and see what all's going on.
See, we have been taught that. That's why I say we've heard that, and it's been really people that I don't think they've looked back at this talk, because he's about to go into more specificity, not just in leadership. Yeah.
I'll let you finish his, but John Taylor said, God lives and his eyes are over us and his angels are around and about us, and they are more interested in us than we are in ourselves. 10,000 times, but we do not know it.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that's why, again, and I get it, this is my opinion. My opinion is simply that I'm not sure that there is necessarily a spirit of Elijah. That if they're on the other side and they're interested, and you start doing your genealogy, where are they going to be?
Yeah.
and you're going to feel my urgency, and you're going to feel my love, and you're going to, all those things we ascribe to the spirit of Elijah is this urgency and a love coming from the other side. I think it's literally them. Yeah. That's my belief.
So I think there's like at least three categories, though. There's leadership, and then there's a supporting role of like a ministering angel. But even below that, if you would call it below that, there's just, they're like us, and they're growing and developing. And even if they can't interfere with what's going on in my life, they can learn from all my mistakes. And I have so many that it takes
You think it takes a lot of ten? Yeah.
You know? No, I think...
You've got the 1,000 musicians just working on you.
They're learning and growing at a minimum, if not interacting or participating.
Yeah, okay. Now, he's going to go on to say, accompanying that sense or feeling, I am impressed with the thought that I would not do at this moment, say or do one thing that would be taken as unwise or imprudent, including punching out a teacher, or that would give offense to any of my former associates and co-laborers in the work of the Lord. Okay? And if you have a sense that I'm now the prophet, but Joseph and Brigham are watching everything that I do, yeah, I think that would weigh on you a little bit. But he's going to say, I would not like to say one thing or express a thought that would grieve the heart of Joseph or of Brigham or of John or Wilford or Lorenzo or any of the faithful associates in the ministry. Sometimes, he says, the Lord expands our vision from this point of view and this side of the veil, that we feel and seem to realize that we can look beyond the thin veil that separates us from that other sphere. Now, he's going to have 2 years of this. Remember, we're still 18 months away from section 138, and we'll see if we get to it today, if not next week, but maybe today, where he is just spending more time in the spirit world than he's spending in this life. He's just kind of going back and forth, okay? I believe we move and have our being in the presence of heavenly messengers and of heavenly beings. We are not separate from them. We begin to realize more and more fully as we become acquainted with the principles of the gospel, if they've been revealed anew in this dispensation, that we are closely related to our kindred, to our ancestors, to our friends and associates and co-laborers who have preceded us in the spirit world. Okay? Our kindred, our ancestors, our friends and associates and co-laborers, we're connected to them. They are there and they are with us. And again, when we say, well, they're too busy doing other things, if the work of the Lord is happening like in our temples, the things that we're doing, what would be more important to them than the work that we might do?
We're family.
Yeah.
And we have that family relationship back generations.
Yeah.
And they are interested in their posterity.
Well, sure. And then, so then take them out of this sphere. They lay their body in the grave, and now suddenly their minds and hearts are expanding, and now they're returning with even more love. And so that's what he says. We are much more connected than we have any idea. Okay? We cannot forget them. The hearts of the children are being turned to the fathers, right? We cannot forget them. We do not cease to love them. We always hold them in our hearts, in memory, and thus we are associated and united to them with ties that we cannot break, we cannot dissolve, or free ourselves from. Okay?
So that would apply to non-members as well as church members?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've thought about, think about the cultures, Native Americans, so many, and even around the Incas and the Mayas and stuff like that, their connection is to who?
Their
fathers. It's always back to the fathers, and they're always. In fact, it's funny. I was just listening to a podcast just this morning on my way here, and I'm listening to a guy that spent a lot of time in India, and he's talking about.
I was listening to that too.
Were you just listening to it?
Yeah.
So you know where I'm going with this. He's talking about that his first experience on the shores of the Ganges was the fact that there were bodies that were lying there that were dead, that covered them, and then on the shore with everything else going on, they would burn those bodies. And then when they were reduced to ashes, they would then take the ashes and sweep them into the river. So now there's ashes there, and then people would bathe in that. It's like they're going to literally then get into the river. And they're bathing in the ashes of their fathers. I just think there is this, across cultures, there is a draw to our fathers and who went before. Okay? Even if they're not member, we understand what that spirit is, but they don't, but they feel the draw, that roots thing that we had in the 80s. Okay? So he's gonna say, so if this is the case. If we are that connected to them, if this is the case with us in our finite condition, surrounded by our mortal weaknesses and short-sightedness, lack of inspiration and wisdom from time to time, how much more certain is it and reasonable and consistent to believe that those who have been faithful, who have gone beyond and are still engaged in the work of salvation of the souls of men, the opening of prison doors, we'll talk about that later, to them that are bound, proclaiming liberty to the captives, who can see us better than we can see them, that they know us better than we know them. Ouch. They know us better than we know them.
I think they know us better than we know us.
Yeah. They have advanced. We are advancing. We are growing as they have grown. We are reaching the goal they have attained to. And therefore, I claim that we live in their presence. They see us. They are solicitous for our welfare. They love us now more than ever. How comforting is that? That connection, that bond and everything, and they love us more than they did in this life.
Brother Hinckley, can I share a personal experience with this? That I don't really talk about a lot, but about 3 years ago, I got sick with the flu. No big deal. But my husband just happened, and my youngest, we were supposed to be taking him off to BYU that very time. And of course, because I had the flu, my husband was like, I'll just take him, you stay home. And then maybe when you're feeling better in a few days, you can get another flight. And I was laying at home all by myself, but I was so just lethargic that I could not get out of bed. So I just kind of like stayed in my bed for, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. I am not kidding you. I fell asleep in the middle of the day, and I had what I'll call a dream. But my grandparents, none of which were members, but I've done all their work, they all came to me, they were all standing there. The only one that spoke in my dream was my grandfather. And he said, "You are dying. Go to the ER.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. He did. He said it twice, because I think I'm one of those people that I have to hear things twice before I'll act. But I immediately woke up, and I looked at the clock, and I realized that I'd only been asleep for a little over 30 minutes. But there was this sense that it was real, and I needed to take it seriously. Now, my next problem was I thought, how am I going to get there? Because I'm too weak to drive myself. Do I call? I'm literally sitting there thinking, do I call an ambulance? Do I call a friend? You know, I was trying to figure out how to do it. Right then, my son had a prompting. He just happened to be like 20 minutes away, staying at his in-laws. And he just said, Mom, text me when you're feeling better and I'll come see you. And I said, well, can you come right now? And I did. I went to the ER, and my potassium level was so low, they thought I was about to go into cardiac arrest.
Wow.
And all the signs I had were I just had the flu. So you'll never be able to convince me
that they're not real, deeply involved.
But that's not real. Yep.
I'll share a story. About 15 years ago, I was one of the first times I was teaching at Education Week. We were up in Rexburg. I'd actually sort of forgotten this. Cindy reminded me of this. And one of the first classes that I did, I talked on in the presence of the divine. And after I got done with the class, there's some very kind of spiritual experiences that happened around that I won't go into, but I was teaching on this, and afterwards a man came up to me in tears and just was thanking me for the class, and he said, I just need to tell you, and I think he's from Canada, and he said, just a matter of just a few weeks ago, his daughter had gone into a dental appointment, and she died on the dental chair. A weird kind of thing, and she just died, and he was inconsolable. And so he's LDS, he was just going to go for a drive, and he was driving through Rexburg, and he thought he'd stop at Rick's College and take a break. And then he looked around, and it's like, oh, there's a conference going on. He says, yeah, it's Education Week. And he says, well, I've only got like a couple of hours, then I've got to keep on going. And they said, well, you know, it's going on. And he says, I only had time for one class, and I, on random, picked your class. And I had no idea what you were going to talk on, but I just picked your class. I was in the Hinckley building that's just up on the campus there. And he came in and sat down, and this is what I taught. And coming out of that, he just like, I can't tell you how important this was to me, because I've been grieving so much, and the idea that she is she's there and loves me greater just made all the difference for him. So they're kind of involved, and we could go on and on. You guys have all got stories, I think, of these kind of connections. So I claim that we live in their presence. They see us. They're solicitous for our welfare. They love us now more than ever. For now they see the dangers that beset us. They can comprehend better than ever the weaknesses that are liable to mislead us into dark and forbidden paths. They see the temptations and evils that beset us in this life and the proneness of mortal beings to yield to temptation and to wrongdoing. Hence, their solicitude for us and their love for us and their desire for our well-being must be greater than what we feel for ourselves. Now, to what extent that happens person to person, I don't know. But he just said, my sense is that they are involved. And talk about how comforting that is, right? Okay. So, let me combine this with one other. Again, Jim, you'll appreciate this. So that is April 6th on 1916. Okay, we get to April 7th, 1918, so 2 years later. And now he's going to have a second vision that again, we've all heard of. Remember this story? He has a dream of Joseph Smith where he's called to a meeting. He's in Hawaii. He's called to a meeting in the dream, and he knows that he's supposed to go be meeting, and he begins to be understanding that the meeting is with Joseph Smith. And as he's on his way there, he's late, but he recognizes in Hawaii, he hasn't had a chance to launder his clothes very much, he's dirty. So he stops off to wash his clothes and to wash his body, and then he puts it back on, and then he hustles into the meeting. And he says he gets there, and he can see a group of brethren kind of talking among themselves, and one of them is Joseph Smith. And he says, Joseph Smith turns around, sees him come in, walks up to him, and he says,
"You're late."
And Joseph Smith says, "Yes, but I'm clean." and then Joseph is going to then give him some direction and guidance in the things that he's doing. Okay, so I say there is this 2-year period where he's kind of floating back and forth here. Okay. All right, that said. So, this interesting series of events is going to happen. We've got time to do it today. 6 months later, the October 1918 conference. Okay, by that time, people are starting to, there's some illness going on. It's not quite the height of the Spanish influenza, but there's a lot of empty seats in the tabernacle. There's a lot of illness going on. Okay, so very, very few people. But he's going to get up in 1918, and he's going to say, "As most of you, I suppose, are aware, I have undergone a siege of very serious illness for the last 5 months. It would be impossible for me on this occasion to occupy sufficient time to express the desires of my heart and my feelings as I would desire to express them to you. I will not, I dare not, attempt to enter upon the things that have been resting upon my mind this morning. And I shall postpone for a future time, the Lord being willing, my attempt to tell you some of the things that are in my mind and dwell in my heart. I have not lived alone these last 5 months. I have dwelt in the spirit of prayer, of supplication, of faith, determination, and I have had my communication with the Spirit of the Lord continuously." Okay? Now, here's what he's not telling you. In reality, he had received the vision of the dead, which we now have as section 138 of the Doctrine and Covenants, the day before conference. He'd already had that. He receives it on the 3rd of, like a couple of days before. On the 3rd of October, he will receive section 138, the vision of the dead, okay? Now, what will happen with that is that it's recorded immediately after conference. He's received it, but he hasn't yet written it down, okay? So immediately after conference, he will write it down. It will then be read by Joseph Fielding Smith to the assembled Quorum of the Twelve on October 31st, who will then approve it as scripture, even though it's not canonized yet.
October
31st? I know. The day, Dia de los Muertos? Yeah. The Day of the Dead? Yeah. Perfect, right?
Actually, it's November 1st, which is the Day of the Dead.
Okay. Oh, that also on the eve of Hallowed Eve. For that. Okay, perfect. Okay, so I just think it's interesting. So he's going to read that, but Joseph F. was so sick that he couldn't attend the meeting. So Joseph Fielding is going to be the one that's going to present it. I'm realizing, since I grew up with President McKay, and then I remember very clearly when Joseph Fielding was ordained, I really would have liked to have talked to Joseph Fielding and asked some questions. Actually, President McKay, too, would have had some great insights, but to be able to touch people that had these kind of experience. But Joseph Fielding is going to do that. And then, okay, so now we have it written down. They approve it. What do they do? Well, they'll publish it in the December Improvement Era. Okay? And it will. And so it will be sitting out there. Charlie, when is it finally canonized as scripture? Do you remember?
I remember it being...
Yeah, you would have.
But I can't tell you when.
I'm on my mission in 1976, and my dad sends me a letter, and he says, Isn't it great, the two new additions that we have to the Pearl of Great Price? And we're out like, we had no idea that this had happened, okay? And it's only later that we find out, okay, no, it's been added to the Pearl of Great Price, two visions, one by Joseph Smith on the Celestial Kingdom, one, this vision of the dead from Joseph F., and then when they reconstitute in 1980, when they reconstitute the scriptures, they move it from the Pearl of Great Price to the Doctrine and Covenants and make it section 137, 138. Okay? But it's not canonized as canonized scripture till 1976. Why, I don't know. But it just had been sitting out there. So people have been quoting it forever.
But don't we do that now? I mean, technically, the Proclamation on the Family hasn't been canonized. It's been out for 30 years.
Right. Right, but we're a little slow on stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that said, then, let's see if I can't get this. Oops.
I'm not sure we'll ever canonize the Proclamation on the Family.
We may not.
Things change, you know, and all of a sudden we canonize it, and then they can't.
Okay, so here is, section 138, and this is what he's going to say. On the 3rd of October in the year 1918, I sat in my room pondering on the scriptures. What was he pondering? The atonement, okay? Made by the Son of God for the redemption of the world and the great and wonderful love that through his atonement and obedience, all mankind may be saved. And he's engaged, he's reading the Bible, okay? Now he's going to bring, there are a couple of doctrinal things that he will then bring that change our understanding of all of this. In fact, Jesus the Christ, written by James Talmage, had been published 1915, I think. So this is after that. And he's going to actually change a couple of things that are in Jesus the Christ. There were a couple of errors. And he is kind of correcting that. Okay? And so here's one of them. By which it says that Jesus then goes and he preaches to the spirits in prison, okay, and in Jesus the Christ, it talks about how Jesus goes to all the spirits, including the spirits in prison. But he's going to clarify something here. I don't want to get you too dizzy while I'm scrolling here.
You're doing it.
Is it working? Don't look. It is right. We sick yet? Okay. Look at verse 50. You can say, quoting, for the dead had looked upon their long absence of their spirits as a bondage. So when he says, when he goes to preach to the spirits in prison, who's in prison?
Everybody.
If you don't have your body, when he's speaking in prison, he's going to say everybody looks upon their bodies as a bondage, and the Lord taught, but he's going to say, anyway, you guys can look at it, but part of what he's going to end up saying is, and Jesus did not go to the disobedient. Jesus the Christ said he did. He's going to say he did not go to the spirits that were disobedient, but what does he do?
He organizes
the missionary work, and they're going to go into that. Okay? But part of what he's trying to say, so he's going to give us this great vision of these people. Hold on, don't look again. We're going dizzy. Okay. That's why I've been thinking a little bit about what happened this morning with the hostages coming, and there were 400,000 in Hostage Square in Tel Aviv last night, and they waited all night because it didn't happen until early morning. Okay, but there it says this vast multitude waited and conversed, rejoicing in the hour of their deliverance from the chains of death. And in the middle of all of that, the Son of God appears, declaring liberty to the captive. And there he preached to them the everlasting gospel. So he's, and the doctrine of resurrection and redemption of mankind from the fall and from individual sins on condition of repentance. And unto the wicked, he says, he did not go. And among the ungodly and unrepentant who had defiled themselves while in the flesh, his voice was not raised. Neither did the rebellious who rejected the testimonies and warnings behold his presence. Where they were, darkness reigned, but among the righteous there was peace. And the saints rejoiced in redemption, bowed the knee, and acknowledged the Son of God and the deliverer from the chains of hell, and their countenance shone. So imagine what he's watching. He's just watching this excited moment and everything. Again, I'm thinking about what I was watching this morning as 400,000 people in Tel Aviv were watching on big screens, and the first hostages start to appear, and they just exploded. We've been held hostage too. Israel has been held hostage. We're all hostages here, okay? And now the captives have been released. And now the joy and the reuniting and everything that's happening today, in some ways, parallels this a bit, I think. Their countenance has shown radiance from the presence of the Lord upon them, and they sang praises unto his holy name. Okay? So, again, not bad for a guy that doesn't get revelations. Okay? Comments on that? Is that? Yeah.
Just one little thing is that it wasn't everybody that hadn't been resurrected yet. When Jesus goes to the spirit world after his...
Well, he's not going to the pre-existence.
No. When Jesus was resurrected himself, there were many who rose up, and it was so important that he had to reiterate it when he went to the Nephites.
Yes.
Say, why wasn't this written down? And they had to hurry and do that.
That's right. Because for some, this was happening right away. Okay. And it is funny how sometimes in a lot of Christian settings, they kind of leave out the fact that there were a lot of people resurrected. And it says, and were seen by many. So everybody had known that there was resurrections going on. Okay? Anyway, so what he's going to say ultimately, but behold, from among the righteous, he organized his forces, appointed messengers, clothed with power and authority, and commissioned them to go forth and carry the light of the gospel to them that were in darkness, even to all the spirits of men. And thus was the gospel preached to the dead. And chosen messengers went forth to declare the acceptable day, proclaim liberty to the captives who were bound, even to all those who would repent and receive the gospel. Okay? So, yeah.
Well, with that, we know that he was there for a period of time, and he, just as he had done with his own apostles and in the new world, he had also in the world, it sounds like he further commissioned them to go further and now to go into the darker side of that spirit prison and try to work there. But then he was resurrected. He left that paradise spirit world environment and then returned to his Father. So my question is this. Why, even in the church, are so many people believe that Christ is still there as they pass into the spirit world, again, in prison or in paradise, and think that they will be greeted by Jesus Christ at that point in their life, which has also led to this near-death experience thing that
yes,
many people
absolutely. Or the other one.
Or am I wrong?
No.
Is he still, he's not in there, no, but Kurt, he's at the door and he's letting them in, or is Peter there?
Well, let me put a parallel to that. That means that if we're going to get to the other side of the veil, and now we have a chance to have our minds expanded and all of the foibles of mortality maybe stripped away from us, and now we have a chance to hear the gospel and learn it and repent and stuff like that, it would also be important that we don't immediately then remember the preexistence, because that's the other one that goes with it. I'm going to see Jesus and remember me in the preexistence. In order to have that full ability to grow and learn and accept the gospel and have faith, you're right. We can't have Jesus standing right there, and we can't remember immediately the preexistence. Yeah, I'm with you. But somehow that popular view is there. It's out there, yeah.
So I consider this to be an issue of mechanics. How it works, okay? And God has revealed to us in the scriptures that he has allowed people to misunderstand things.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we have any kind of a contract with God that he is going to or teach us everything to our correct understanding.
Nor would we understand it even if...
At this point.
Yeah.
And so when you get... Some people get hung up on the mechanics.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when I read where it says that God won't have a servant at the gate and that it'll be him, to me, I read that as a celestial being is not a servant. They're one with God, you know. And there's just so many mechanical things that we can get wrong.
We have a side of us in our culture that wants to be almost as literal as the Pharisees, and we're taking everything literally, and we have a hard time even with some sense of symbolism. And I mean, in our priesthood class yesterday, we were having this fun discussion about Judgment Day, and
who's going to judge me?
Well, there is this view, and you know, we have the literalists in the group that are still on this is going to be a great and dreadful day, which really means. There is that moment when I'm coming out of the spirit world and I'm standing before the judge and the gavel is up and I'm about to find my fate. Did I make the celestial kingdom? Was I 5 points short and I'm going to end up in the terrestrial kingdom? So it's great and dreadful going, am I going to be acquitted or am I sentenced to life? You know, and now I'm going to tell you what the judge has decided. And so great and dreadful means in the next 5 seconds, I could find out that I'm separated from my family forever. Or I'm going to find out that I... And yet, my own belief is if we see the symbolicness of... There are a multiple judging moments along the way. We're our own judges. And so we're saying, no, that's why President Oakes is talking about the fact it's what we become. It's not what we've done. We're judging ourselves because we'll know whether we are... ready to live with God.
It's self-paced.
Yes.
And if you go to 49 and 50, I mean, you stop right short of that, but we're taught the resurrection and we're given power for the resurrection when we're ready for the resurrection.
Yeah.
And you're going to be ready way before me. But.
Not a chance. The other thing that would come out of this, and then maybe I'll kind of wrap up with this. There, I believe there's also a feeling here of greater mercy, that all these people that were in the dark are now going to be taught the gospel and they're going to be taught the principles and they can accept it and they're going to move forward. And you get a sense maybe that God is more merciful and generous about how many people are going to ultimately end up living with him. It breathes the spirit of that. So, yeah.
I'm going to tell a story. You talked about how people evolve, progress in the next life. When I joined the church, my mother, who I dearly loved and we were always so close, was so unhappy. I mean, beyond unhappy. She came to my baptism and she literally wailed on the front row. And as she learned more about the church, she was so sure that I was going to learn sooner or later all the bad things, you know. And one day, I don't know how it came out, we were talking about, I don't know how it came out, what we were talking about, but she got so upset, she says, "You promised me that when I die, you will not do my work in that temple." And I was so tired of the conflict, I said, "Okay." Now, I regret saying that, but it was just like, I don't want to fight anymore. And when she passed away, I didn't do her work for years because I keep my word. I tried to. I felt like
I promised you, Mom, I'll let you.
Well, I know people laugh, but I was brought up to be very, very honest.
Sure,
sure. You gave your word, and right. I had this conflict. Well, finally somebody talked me, said a different thing. But, so my husband and I at the time went to the Dallas Temple and we did her work. Okay, but I thought, well, maybe she'll be mad, but I still did it. Okay, fast forward 20 years. By that time, my father had died. It was like 1999. My mother died in 1978. And I could go to the temple and have be sealed with my parents, get my father's work done, all of that. I had no emotional feelings about doing it. I didn't. I was just a good little German girl, and I was doing what I was told to do. I'm not exaggerating. I just went in. I'm going to do it. When I left that sealing room, I have never been more moved, except when I was sealed to my late husband, that this was that this took and that they wanted this to happen.
Mm.
So I think in those 20 years, things did change.
Yeah.
And I am a firm believer of all of this.
That we change. That's one of the reasons I find interesting that one of the things that happened with what we call the Great Apostasy, and we're talking about how the Catholic world looks at things. It's interesting that even in the Catholic world, there is a sense that we don't know at what point they have the dead have received enough to be saved. So they're actually going to go into purgatory, but even in purgatory, there's a sense that they are still progressing. They're moving it. Somewhere along the way, they're going to be taken up into heaven. So there's a sense that those on this side of the veil, if they're lighting candles or even the what indulgences got blamed for and stuff like that, it was still a sense of those of us on this side in life can help those on the other side.
They're the only Christian church that has a relationship with their dead other than us.
It is.
All the Protestants, they have no relationship with their dead.
That's right. It finished, and that was one of the things that was actually lost in the Reformation,
mm-hmm.
is not all that stuff is gone. You just got to get you to heaven. But what about those that have been? Well, they're kind of on their own. Well, they accepted Jesus or they didn't. And the beautiful thing about Catholicism is they're like, no, they're still. We can help. We can do something to... by our going to Mass and confession can help them.
Well, one of the things that they do is, I don't know if it's Catholics or if it's the Hispanic Catholics, but we do, after they have passed, of course, you know, they do a rosary at the funeral service and stuff,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but we also do 10 days straight of rosary.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Every day... for 10 days straight, we say a rosary and we do the whole rosary. I mean, there's an easy way to do it, and then there's the more complicated,
yeah.
all of the, you know, stuff. And so, I mean, we do.
Because we're helping them. It's a, right. There are things that we can do here that will make it.
Get their sins. Forgiven and.
And speed it up. We don't know how fast it will be. That part of them, but at least we can do something. I think that's great. Yeah.
And what I learned from my experience, that you never make judgments or decisions for people on the other side of the veil.
Yeah.
It's hard, but you know, you don't do that. You don't know.
That's one of the reasons why, maybe I'll just kind of finish with this. I think if we ever maintain a sense in our heart of saying, I'm going to get to the celestial kingdom, and I'm going to be really ticked if I find certain people there.
And you won't be there.
That's right. It's true. I don't deserve to be there anyway. I'm missing the whole point here.
Nobody in the celestial kingdom is unhappy that somebody else is there.
Yeah, yeah. But in this life, it sort of makes sense. I better have a bigger mansion, because dang it, I worked hard. And, you know, and they didn't. So...
There's a book, the man who did, I don't know who the author was, but I sold it in the bookstore, and it was about cartoons about Protestant churches, not to be picking on him, but that's what it was. And there was a man arguing with the minister. He says, "Don't tell me I'm not going to heaven. My great-grandfather founded this church." And another funny one, which I'm sorry, I think was funny. These people are going down the escalator, and you can see the flames of hell coming up. And one man turns to the other one and says, "Don't worry, our church voted 3-4 that this place does not exist."
Okay, yeah, Peter.
Well, I think it's actually getting more complicated now. Now this quantum mechanics involved. Okay, well, we actually body has soul. When you die, we actually don't die. Everything, our body, our soul, it can in terms of wave. It's just like a ripple. Yeah. It can originally go that way and go larger and larger. And this is getting very more complicated now, beyond we can understand.
That's
because
right.
We don't die. It's there. The wave is still moving. Maybe 5,000 years ago, it's still there.
Yeah.
And somewhere over there, we don't know how big the universe. We have no idea. But still there, they say that, well, this thing really, really so hard. We have come here to hear from you, you know. And God invented so many laws, like thermodynamic and that kind of stuff. And God invented about like a statistic.
Yeah.
And things are very complicated.
I kind of think when we get to the other side, Peter, we're going to find out, maybe it wasn't as complicated as our mortal brains tried to make it. That it really turned out we were just supposed to be more loving, and it kind of those things happen. Yeah.
Well, is there any is there any room for thinking that this final day of judgment, this grand day of judgment, is really dependent? We say some people are going to take longer, and so on and so forth. Is when we talk about the day of judgment, is it our day of judgment or for all?
Yeah, I know. But the only judgment frame that we have is watching mortal criminal courts.
Right.
And we want to make it a mortal criminal court and wonder what the jury is going to say about us. So anyway, we need to wrap up. Good stuff. I don't think that there are a few doctrines and topics that are of universal interest to us than what happens on the other side. And I think part of what happens, what we bring as Latter-day Saints to the whole Christian discussion is a better, clearer understanding of what's over there and what's involved there. And so much of that came through the voice and the mind and the heart of Joseph F. Smith, for which I'm grateful. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Can we get a closing prayer? Okay, thanks, Shana.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we're so very grateful to thee for the beginning.
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.